Below in the preparation chambers at ground level, Paulus girded up before the fight. Leto stood with him behind a barricade, listening to the impatient crowd. "Father, I'm uneasy about the risk you're taking. You shouldn't do this, especially not for me." The old Duke brushed aside the comment. "Leto, lad, you must understand that governing people and winning their loyalty consists of more than just signing papers, collecting taxes, and attending Landsrad meetings." He straightened his magenta cape, preened in front of a mirror. "I depend on those people out there to produce the most that Caladan can provide. They must do so willingly, with hard work, and not just for their own profit, but for their honor and glory. If House Atreides was ever to go to war again, these people would shed their blood for me. They would lay down their lives under our banner." He fiddled with his armor. "Tighten this for me." Leto grabbed the string fasteners of the black leather plate, tugged them, and cinched the knots tight. He kept silent, but nodded to show he understood. "As their duke, I need to give them something back, prove that I'm worthy. And it's not just for entertainment, but to instill in their minds that I'm a man of grand stature, of heroic proportions, someone blessed by God to rule them. I can't do that unless I put myself before them. Leadership is not a passive process." Paulus checked his shield belt, then smiled through his beard. "No one is too old to learn," he quoted. "That's a line from the Agamemnon play, just to show that I'm not always sleeping when I appear to be." Thufir Hawat, the stern-faced weapons master, stood beside his duke. As a loyal mentat, Hawat would not speak out against his superior's decisions. Instead, he gave the best advice he could, whispering to Paulus the patterns he had seen in the movements of this new batch of mutated Seleucid bulls. Leto knew his mother would be up in the stands in the ducal spectator box. She would be dressed in her finery, wearing colorful gauzy veils and robes, playing her part, waving to the people. The night before, once again, there had been much heated discussion behind the bedroom doors. Finally, Duke Paulus had simply silenced her with a barked command. Afterward, he had gone to sleep, resting for the following day's exertions. The Duke put on his green-bordered cap, then took the equipment he would need to conquer the wild bull. His poniards and a long, feathered vara with nerve toxin on the lance tip. Thufir Hawat had suggested that the stable master slightly tranquilize the bull to deaden its rampaging impulses. But the Duke was a man who loved to face a challenge. No drug-dulled opponent for him. Paulus clipped the activation pack onto his shield belt and powered up the field. It was only a half-shield, used to guard his side. The Duke used a garishly brilliant cape called a muleta to cover his other side. Paulus bowed first to his son, then his mentat, and then the trainers waiting at the entrance to the arena. "Time for the show to begin." Leto watched him swirl about, and, like a bird on a mating display, strut out into the open Plaza de Toros. At his appearance, cheers thundered out with a roar far louder than any Seleucid bulls. Leto stood behind the barricade, blinking into the glare of the open sun. He smiled as his father made a slow circuit of the arena, waving his cape, bowing, greeting his ecstatic people. Leto could sense the love and admiration they had for this brave man, and it warmed his heart. Waiting there in the shadows, Leto vowed to do all he could to study his father's triumphs, so that one day he would command such respect and devotion from the people. Triumphs. This would be another in a long list of them for his father, Leto assured himself. But he couldn't help worrying. Too much could change in the flicker of a shield, the flash of a sharp horn, the stamp of a hoof. Tones sounded, and an announcer's voice gave introductory details of the impending Corrida de Toros. With a flourish of a sequined glove, Duke Paulus gestured toward the broad reinforced doors on the opposite side of the arena. Moving to another archway for a better view, Leto reminded himself that this would be no sham performance. His father would be battling for his very life. Stable boys had been tending the ferocious beasts, and stablemaster Iresk had personally selected one for the day's corrida. After inspecting the animal, the old duke had been satisfied, certain the crowd would be equally pleased by its ferocity. He looked forward to the fight. Heavy gates opened with a grinding of suspensor hinges, and the Seleucid bull charged out, shaking its massive, multiple-horned head in the dazzling light. Its faceted eyes glittered with feral rage. The scales on the mutated creature's back reflected iridescent colors from its black hide. Duke Paulus whistled and waved his cape. "Over here, stupid!" The spectators laughed. Turning toward him, the bull lowered its head with a loud, bubbling snort. Leto noticed that his father hadn't yet switched on his protective shield. Instead, Paulus snapped and fluttered his colorful cape, trying to draw the wrath of the beast. The Seleucid bull pawed and snorted on the sandy arena floor, then charged. Leto wanted to cry out, to warn his father. Had the man simply forgotten to switch on his protection? How could he possibly survive without a shield? But the bull thundered past, and Paulus swept his cape gracefully to one side, letting the creature strike the diversionary target. Its hooked horns shredded the bottom of the fabric into ragged frays. While it was coming about, the old duke turned his back to the bull, exposed and overconfident. He bowed mockingly toward the crowd before he stood straight, then calmly, patiently, flicked on his personal shield. The bull attacked again, and now the duke used his poniard to toy with it, pricking through its thick scaled hide before slashing a stinging yet minor wound along its flank. The creature's faceted eyes saw multiple images of its colorfully garbed tormentor. It charged again. Moving too fast to penetrate the shield, Leto thought. But if the bull tires and slows, he could be even more dangerous. As the fight continued, Leto saw how his father was playing this up for all the spectacle he could muster, tantalizing the audience to amuse them. Old Paulus could have killed the Seleucid bull at any time, yet he drew out the moment, savored it. From the reactions of the spectators, Leto knew this would be an event talked about for years. The rice farmers and fishermen led such dreary, hard-working lives. But this celebration would fix a proud image of their duke forever in their minds. "Look what old Paulus was doing," they would say, "despite his age." Eventually the bull became exhausted, its eyes reddened with blood, its snorts heavy and tired as it spilled its life fluid onto the powdery surface of the arena. Duke Paulus himself now chose to end the fight. He had dragged the sport along for nearly an hour. Though dripping with sweat, he somehow maintained his regal appearance and did not allow his manner to show weariness or his fine clothes to be disheveled. Up in the stands, Lady Helena continued to wave her pennants, smiling fixedly down at the spectacle. By now the Seleucid bull was like a maddened machine, a rampaging monster that had few vulnerable spots in its black-scaled armor. As the beast ran at him again, its gait staggering, its gleaming horns pointed like spears, Duke Paulus feinted to the left, then returned as the bull surged past. Then Paulus swung sideways, tossed his flapping cape to the dust, and gripped the shaft of his Vara lance in both hands. He threw all of his strength into a powerful side thrust. flawlessly performed, magnificently executed. The blade of the lance drove home through a chink in the Seleucid bull's armored hide, sliding through an intersection of bone and skull, skewering straight through to impale both of the creature's separated brains. The most difficult, most sophisticated way to kill it. The bull ground to a halt, wheezing, groaning, and suddenly dead. Its carcass slumped like a crashing spaceship onto the ground. Planting his foot on the horned head of the bull, Duke Paulus heaved against his lance, pulled the bloodied blade out, and dropped it onto the ash-covered ground. Next he drew his sword, and, raising it high, twirled it in a triumphant gesture. As one, the people in the stands surged to their feet, screaming, howling, and cheering. They waved their banners, snatched bouquets from flower pots, and tossed the blossoms onto the arena floor. They sang out Paulus' name over and over. Reveling in the adoration, the Atreides patriarch smiled and turned about, opening his coat so that the spectators could see his blood-spattered, sweat-drenched form. He was the hero now. He had no need to show off his finery. After the throbbing cheers had died down, many minutes later, the Duke raised his sword again and struck downward, hacking repeatedly until he had severed the head of the bull. Finally, he plunged the bloody sword into the soft ground of the plaza and used both hands to grasp the horns of the bull and lift its head high. "Leto!" he shouted over his shoulder, his voice booming into the acoustics of the Plaza de Toros. "Leto, my son, come out here!" Leto, still in the shadows of the archway, hesitated a moment, then marched forth. He held his head high as he crossed the hoof-trampled dirt to stand at his father's side. The crowd cheered with renewed enthusiasm. Old Duke Paulus turned and presented his son with the bloodied head of his kill. "I give you Leto Atreides," he announced to the audience while pointing at his son. "Your future duke!" The crowd continued to applaud and shout hurrahs. Leto grasped one of the bull's horns. He and his father stood together, holding the defeated beast's head high, the trophy oozing thick red drops onto the sand. As Leto heard the people echo his name, he felt deep stirrings within, and wondered for the first time if this was truly what it felt like to be a leader of men. Nki, slow-acting poison that builds up in the adrenal glands. One of the most insidious toxins permitted under the accords of guild peace and the restrictions of the Great Convention. See War of Assassins. The Assassin's Handbook.
The Emperor will never die, you know, Shaddam.
A small man with oversized dark eyes and a weasel face, Hasimir Fenring, sat opposite the shield ball console from his visitor, Crown Prince Shaddam.
"At least not while you're young enough to enjoy the throne."
With a sharp, darting gaze, Fenring watched the black shield ball come to rest on a low-scoring point. Completing his turn at the game, the heir to the Imperium clearly wasn't happy about the result. They had been close companions for most of their lives, and Fenring knew exactly how to distract him at the right moment. From the game room of Fenring's luxurious penthouse, Shaddam could see the lights of his father's imperial palace glittering on the gentle hillside a kilometer away. With Fenring's aid, he had disposed of his older brother Fafnir years and years ago, and still the golden lion throne seemed no closer. Shaddam went over to the balcony and drew a long, deep breath. He was a strong-featured man in his mid-30s, with a firm chin and aquiline nose. His reddish hair was cut short and oiled and styled into a perfect helmet.
In an odd way, he looked similar to the century-old busts of his father, sculpted during the early decades of Elrud's reign. It was early evening, and two of Kaitain's four moons hung low in the sky beyond the gigantic imperial building. Illuminated gliders rode the calm skies of dusk, chased by flocks of songbirds. Sometimes, Shaddam just needed to get away from the sprawling palace. 136 years as Padishah Emperor, Fenring continued in his nasal voice. And old Elrud's father ruled for more than a century himself. Think about it. Your father took the throne when he was only 19, and you're almost twice that age. The narrow-faced man looked with huge eyes at his friend. Doesn't that bother you? Shaddam didn't respond, stared at the skyline, knowing he should return to the game. But he and his friend had bigger games to play. After his long years of close association, Fenring knew that the imperial heir could not deal with complex problems when other amusements distracted him. Very well, then, I will end this diversion. My turn, he said. Fenring lifted a rod on his side of the shimmering shield globe and dipped it through the shield to engage a spinning interior disk. This in turn caused a black ball in the center of the globe to levitate into the air. With expert timing, Fenring withdrew the rod, and the ball dropped into the center of an oval receptacle bearing the highest mark. "Damn you, Hasimir, another perfect game for you," Shaddam said, returning from the balcony. "When I'm emperor, though, will you be wise enough to lose to me?" Fenring's oversized eyes were alert and feral. A genetic eunuch, incapable of fathering children because of his congenital deformities, he was still one of the deadliest fighters in the Imperium, so single-mindedly ferocious that he was more than a match for any Sardaukar. When your emperor? Fenring and the Crown Prince held so many deadly secrets between them that neither could imagine keeping knowledge from the other. Shaddam, are you listening to what I'm telling you, He gave an annoyed sigh. You're 34 years old, sitting on your hands and waiting for your life to begin. Your birthright. Elrud could last another 3 decades at least. He's a tough old Berseg, and the way he gulps spice beer, he might outlive both of us. So why even talk about it? Shaddam toyed with the shield ball controls, clearly wanting to play another round. I've got what I need here. You'd rather play games until you're an old man? I thought you had better things in store for you. The destiny of your Corino blood. Ah, yes. And if I don't achieve my destiny, Shaddam said in a bitter tone, where does that leave you? I'll do fine, thank you. Fenring's mother had been trained as a Bene Gesserit before entering imperial service as lady-in-waiting to Elrud's fourth wife. She had raised him well, preparing him for great things. But Hasimir Fenring was disgusted with his friend. At one time, in his late teens, Shaddam had been much more ambitious to claim the imperial throne, even to the point of encouraging Fenring to poison the emperor's eldest son, Fafnir, who had been 46 and eagerly awaiting the crown himself. Now Fafnir was dead for 15 years, and still the old vulture showed no signs of ever dying. At the very least, Elrud should abdicate with good grace. Meanwhile, Shaddam had lost his drive, and instead occupied his time enjoying the pleasures of his station. Being crown prince posed few hardships in life, but Fenring wanted much more, for his friend and for himself. Shaddam glowered at the other man. The crown prince's mother, Habla, had cast him aside as an infant, her only child by Elrud, and let her lady-in-waiting, Chawla Fenring, serve as wet nurse. From boyhood, Shaddam and Hasimir had talked about what they would do when he ascended to the Golden Lion Throne. Padishah, Emperor, Shaddam IV. But for Shaddam, such conversations no longer held their childhood magic. Too many years of reality had settled in, too much waiting to no purpose. His grip on hope and his enthusiasm for the job had faded into apathy. Why not spend the days playing shield ball? "You're a bastard," Shaddam said. "Let's start another game." Ignoring his friend's suggestion, Fenring shut down the console. "Maybe so, but the Imperium has too many critical matters that require attention, and you know as well as I do that your father is bungling the job. If a company head ran his business the way your father runs the Empire, he'd be sacked. Think of the Choam scandal, for example, the Sue Stone skimming operation." "Ah, yes, can't argue with you on that, Hazimir." Shaddam heaved a deep sigh. "Royal impersonators. A duke, a duchess, a whole damned family of fakes. Right under your father's nose. Who was watching? Now they've disappeared to a rogue planet somewhere beyond Imperial control. That should never have occurred, Just imagine the lost profits for Bazel and the adjoining systems. What was Elrood thinking?" Shaddam looked away. He didn't like to bother with serious Imperial matters. They gave him headaches. Given his father's apparent vigor, such detail seemed distant and, by and large, irrelevant to him. But still, Fenring persisted. "The way it looks now, you won't get a chance to do better. 155 years and still in remarkable health. Fondil III before him lived to be 175. What's the longest a Carino emperor has ever lived?" Shaddam frowned and looked longingly at the gaming apparatus. "You know I don't pay attention to things like that, even when the tutor gets angry with me." Fenring jabbed a finger at him. "Elrood will live to 200, mark my words. You have a serious problem, friend, unless you listen to me." He raised his thin eyebrows. "Ah, yes, more ideas from the Assassin's Handbook, I suppose. Be careful with that information. You can get in a lot of trouble with it." "Timid people are destined for nothing better than timid jobs. You and I, Shaddam, have much more in our futures. Think of the possibilities. Hypothetically, of course. Besides, what's wrong with poison? It works nicely and affects only the targeted person, as required by the Great Convention. No collateral deaths, no loss of revenue, no destruction of inheritable property. Nice and neat." "Poisons are for house-to-house assassinations, not for what you're talking about." "You didn't complain when I took care of Fafnir, He'd be in his 60s now, still waiting to taste the throne. Do you want to wait that long?" "Stop," Shaddam insisted, digging in his heels. "Don't even imagine such a course. This isn't right." "And denying you your birthright is? How effective an emperor would you be if you couldn't exercise power until you were old and senile, like your father? Look what's happened on Arrakis. By the time we replaced Abelard Harkonnen, the damage to spice production was already done. Abelard had no idea how to crack the whip, so the workers didn't respect him. Now the Baron cracks it too much, and so morale is way down, leading to rampant defections and sabotage. But you can't really blame the Harkonnens. It all traces back to your father, the Padishah Emperor, and the bad decisions he's made." He continued more quietly. "You owe it to the stability of the Imperium." Shaddam glanced up at the ceiling, as if searching for spy eyes or other listening devices, though he knew that Fenring kept his private penthouse impeccably shielded and regularly scanned. "What kind of poison are you considering?" hypothetically speaking only. Again he stared across the lights of the city at the Imperial Palace. The shimmering structure seemed like a legendary grail, an unattainable prize.
Perhaps something slow-acting,
So Elrod will appear to be aging.
No one will question what's happening since he's so old already. Leave it to me.
As our future emperor, you shouldn't concern yourself with the details of such matters. I have always been your expediter, remember?
Shaddam chewed his lower lip. No one in the Imperium knew more about this man than he did. But could his friend ever turn on him?
Possibly.
Though Fenring knew full well his best path to power lay through Shaddam. How to keep this ambitious friend under control, how to stay a step ahead of him, that was the challenge.
Emperor Elrod IX, aware of Hasimir Fenring's deadly skills, had made use of him in a number of clandestine operations, all of which had been successful. Elrod even suspected Fenring's role in Crown Prince Fafnir's death, but accepted it as part of imperial politics. Over the years, Fenring had murdered at least 50 men and a dozen women, some of whom had been his lovers, of either sex. He took a measure of pride in being a killer who could face the victim or strike behind his back without compunction. There were days Shaddam wished he and the pushy Fenring had never formed a boyhood relationship. Then he wouldn't be hemmed in with difficult choices that he didn't want to think about. Shaddam should have abandoned his crib companion as soon as he could walk. It was risky to be around such an unrelenting assassin, and at times he felt tainted by the association. Still, Fenring was his friend. There was an attraction between them, an undefinable something of which they'd spoken on occasion without fully understanding it. For the present, Shaddam found it easier to accept the friendship, and for his own sake he hoped it was friendship, instead of trying to sever it. That course of action could be extremely dangerous. Close beside him, Shaddam heard a voice that broke his train of thought.
"Your favorite brandy, my prince?"
Looking to one side, Shaddam saw Fenring offering him a large snifter of smoky dark Kirana brandy. He accepted the snifter, but stared at the liquid suspiciously, swirling it around. Was there another color to it? Something not quite mixed in? He put his nose over the lip, inhaling the aroma as if he were a connoisseur, though he was actually trying to detect any foreign chemical. The brandy smelled normal. But then Fenring would have made sure of that. He was a subtle and devious man.
"I can drag out the snooper if you like, but you never need worry about poison from me, Shaddam,"
Fenring said with a maddening smile.
"Your father, however, is in an entirely different position."
"Ah, yes, a slow-acting poison, you say? I suspect you already have a substance in mind. How long will my father live after you begin the process? If we do this at all, I mean."
2 years, maybe three. Long enough to make his decline appear natural."
Shaddam raised his chin, trying to look regal. His skin was perfumed, his reddish hair pomaded and slicked back. "You understand, I might only entertain such a treasonous idea for the sake of the Imperium, to avoid continued calamities at the hands of my father." A crafty smile worked at the edges of the weasel face.
"Of course."
2 or 3 years, Shaddam mused. "Time for me to prepare for the great responsibilities of leadership, I suppose, while you attend to some of the more unpleasant tasks of empire."
"Aren't you going to drink your brandy, Shaddam?"
Shaddam met the hard gaze of the oversized eyes and felt fear course along his spine. He was in too deep not to trust Fenring now. He drew another shaky breath and sipped the rich liqueur. 3 days later, Fenring slipped like a ghost through the shields and poison snoopers of the palace and stood over the sleeping emperor, listening to the smooth purr of his snores. Not a care in the universe, this one. No one else could have gotten into the most secure sleeping chamber of the ancient emperor. But Fenring had his ways. A bribe here, a manipulated schedule there, a concubine made ill, a doorman distracted, the chamberlain sent off on an urgent errand. He had done this many times before, practicing for the inevitable. Everyone in the palace was used to Fenring slinking around, and they knew better than to ask too many questions. Now, according to his precise assessment, which would have made even a Mentat proud, Fenring had 3 minutes, four if he was lucky, enough time to change the course of history. With the same perfect timing he had demonstrated during the shield ball game, as well as during his rehearsals on mannequins and two unfortunate serving women from the kitchen storehouses, Fenring froze in place and waited, gauging the breathing of his victim like a Lhasa tiger about to pounce. In one hand he cradled a long micro-hair needle between two slender fingers, while in the other he held a mist tube. Old Elrood lay on his back, in the precisely correct position, looking like a mummy, his parchment skin stretched tight over his skull. Guided by a certain hand, the mist tube moved closer. Fenring counted to himself, waiting. In a space between Elrood's breaths, Fenring squeezed a lever on the tube and sprayed a powerful anesthetic mist in the old man's face. There was no discernible change in Elrood, but Fenring knew the nerve deadener had taken effect instantaneously. Now he made his thrust. A fiber-fine, self-guiding needle snaked up the old man's nose, through sinus cavities, and into the frontal lobe of his brain. Fenring paused no more than an instant to dispense the chemical time bomb, then withdrew. A few seconds, and it was done, without any evidence or even any pain. Undetectable and multi-layered, the internal machinery had been set in motion. The tiny catalyst would grow and do its damage, like the first rotten cell in an apple. Each time the emperor consumed his favorite beverage, spice beer, his own brain would release tiny doses of catalin. Thus, an ordinary component of the old man's diet would be chemically converted into chamurki, poison administered in a drink. His mind would gradually rot away, a metamorphosis that would be most enjoyable to watch. Fenring loved to be subtle. Kwisatz Haderach, Shortening of the Way. This is the label applied by the Bene Gesserit to the unknown for which they sought a genetic solution. A male Bene Gesserit whose organic mental powers would bridge space and time. Terminology of the Imperium. It was another cold morning. The small blue-white sun, Laujin, peeked over terracotta-tiled rooftops, dissipating the rain. Reverend Mother Anirul Sado Tonkin held the collar of her black robe shut against the moisture-laden wind that whipped up from the south and dampened her short bronze-brown hair. Her hurried footsteps carried her across the wet cobblestones, straight toward the arched doorway of the Bene Gesserit administration building. She was late and ran, even though it was unseemly for a woman of her status to be seen rushing about like a red-faced schoolgirl. Mother Superior and her selected council would be waiting in the chapter chamber for a meeting that could not begin without Anirul. Only she had the sisterhood's complete breeding projections and the full knowledge from other memory in her head. The sprawling mother school complex on Wallach 9 was the base of Bene Gesserit operations throughout the Imperium. The historic first sanctuary of the Sisterhood had been erected here, dating from post-Butlerian jihad days at the beginnings of the great schools of the human mind. Some of the buildings in the training enclave were thousands of years old and echoed with ghosts and memories. Others had been constructed in more recent centuries with styles carefully designed to match the originals. The bucolic appearance of the Mother School complex fostered one of the primary precepts of the Sisterhood: minimal appearance, maximum content. Anirul's own features were long and narrow, giving her a doe-like face, but her large eyes had a depth of millennia in them. The half-timbered stucco and wood structures, a combination of classical architectural styles, had moss-streaked sienna roof tiles and beveled loom enhancement windows designed to concentrate natural light and warmth from the tiny sun. The simple narrow streets and alleys, in tandem with the quaintly archaic appearance of the instructional enclave, belied the subtle complexities and sheer weight of history taught inside. Haughty visitors would not be impressed, and the Sisterhood did not care a whit. Throughout the Imperium, the Bene Gesserit kept a low profile, but they were always to be found in vital areas, tilting the political equilibrium at crux points, watching, nudging, achieving their own aims. It was best when others underestimated them. The sisters encountered fewer obstacles that way. With all of its superficial deficiencies and difficulties, Wallach 9 remained the perfect place to develop the psychic muscles required of reverend mothers. The planet's intricate hive of structures and workers was too valuable, too steeped in history and tradition to be replaced. Yes, there were warmer climates on more hospitable worlds, but any acolyte who could not endure these conditions had no place among the agonies, harsh environments, and often painful decisions a true Bene Gesserit would face. Keeping her quick breaths under control, Reverend Mother Anirul mounted the rain-slick steps of the administration building, then paused to look back across the plaza. She stood straight, tall, but she felt the weight of history and memory bearing down on her. And for a Bene Gesserit, there was little difference between the two. The voices of past generations echoed in other memory, a cacophony of wisdom and experience and opinions available to all reverend mothers, and particularly acute in Anirul. On this spot, the first Mother Superior, Rachela Berto Anirul, after whom Anirul herself had taken her name, had delivered her legendary orations to the embryonic Sisterhood. Rachela had forged a new school from a group of desperate and pliable acolytes still stinging from centuries under the yoke of thinking machines. "Did you realize what you were beginning so long ago?" Anirul asked herself. "How many plots, how many plans, so much you pinned upon a single secret hope." Sometimes the buried presence of Mother Superior Rachela actually answered her from within. But not today. From her access to the multitude of memory lives buried in her psyche, Anirul knew the precise stair-step on which her illustrious ancestor had stood, and could hear the exact long-ago words. A chill coursed her spine, making her pause. Though still young in years and smooth-skinned, she contained an oldness within her, as did all living reverend mothers. But in her, the voices spoke louder. It was reassuring to have the comforting crowd of memories there to provide advice in times of need. It prevented foolish mistakes. But Anirul would be accused of distraction and foolish delay, if she did not get to the meeting. Some said she was far too young to be the Kwisatz mother, but other memory had revealed more to her than to any other sister. She comprehended the precious millennia-old genetic quest for the Kwisatz Haderach better than the other reverend mothers, because the past lives had revealed everything to her, while keeping the details hidden from most Bene Gesserit. The idea of a Kwisatz Haderach had been the sisterhood's dream for thousands upon thousands of years, conceived in dark underground meetings even before the victory of the Jihad. The Bene Gesserit had many breeding programs aimed at selecting and enhancing various characteristics of humanity, and no one understood them all. The genetic lines of the Messiah Project had been the most carefully guarded secret for much of the Imperium's recorded history. So secret, in fact, that even the voices in other memory refused to divulge the details. But to Anirul they had told the whole scheme, and she grasped the full implications. Somehow she had been chosen as this generation's Kwisatz mother, the guardian of the Bene Gesserit's most important goal. The notoriety and the power, however, did not excuse her for being late to the council meetings. Many still saw her as young and impetuous. Swinging open a heavy door covered with hieroglyphics in a language only reverend mothers remembered, she passed through into a foyer where 10 other sisters, all dressed in hooded black abba robes like her own, stood in a cluster. A low murmur of conversation filled the air inside the nondescript building. "Treasures can be hidden within a drab and unpretentious shell," said one popular Bene Gesserit dictum. The other sisters moved aside for Anirul as she glided through their midst like a swimmer parting water. Though her body was tall and large-boned, Anirul succeeded in projecting a grace in her movements. But it did not come easily to her. Whispering, they fell in behind her as she entered the octagonal chapter chamber, the meeting place of the ancient order's leadership. Her footsteps creaked across the worn planks of the floor, and the door groaned shut, locking behind them. White, alaka wood benches rimmed the time-worn room. Mother Superior Harishka sat on one, like a common acolyte. Of mixed parentage, showing bloodlines from distinctive branches of humanity, the Mother Superior was old and bent, with dark, almond eyes peering out from beneath her black hood. The sisters moved to the sides of the chamber and seated themselves on empty white benches, as Mother Superior had. Presently the rustling of robes ceased, and no one spoke. From somewhere the old building creaked. Outside, drizzle fell in silent curtains, muffling the struggling blue-white sunlight. "Anirul, I await your report," Mother Superior finally said, with just a glimmer of annoyance at her tardiness. Harishka commanded the entire sisterhood, but Anirul was vested with full authority to make command decisions on the project. "You have promised us your genetic summary and projections." Anirul took her position in the center of the chamber. Overhead, a vaulted ceiling spread like a flower to the tops of Gothic-stained glass plaz windows.